We'll hear arguments first this morning in 76-695, University of Missouri, Board of Curators, and against Horowitz. Mr. Wright, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I'm Marvin Wright, attorney representing the petitioners in this case. The petitioners are the University of Missouri, the governing board of that institution, the provost for health sciences on the campus of the university located in Kansas City, and the dean of the School of Medicine located on the campus of the University of Missouri at Kansas City. The respondent is Ms. Charlotte Horowitz, who was a student in that medical school until her dismissal for deficient academic performance in 1973. Now, the issue, primary issue before the court today, is that of whether or not a medical student in a public institution of higher education is entitled to a notice of charges and a hearing prior to dismissal from that school for deficient academic performance. The second issue is that of whether or not when a medical student has prior knowledge of deficient academic performance, the reasons are not disclosed and made public, whether or not that student has a stigma imposed upon them under the purview of the 14th Amendment when a formal hearing is not held. The last issue, naturally, is that of whether or not the procedures which were utilized by the University of Missouri were fair to this student and complied with any requirements of procedural due process. Now, the facts, just very briefly, of the case are this. The school was established in 1971. The governing board adopted a document entitled an academic plan. Now, for purposes of the case today, this academic plan established what is called a Council on Evaluation, which is a committee charged with the responsibility of reviewing the academic performance of students and then making appropriate recommendations. There's a second committee, which is referred to as a coordinating committee. The responsibility of this committee is to review recommendations coming out of the first mentioned committee. This latter committee makes recommendations to the dean of the school, and the dean makes final decisions with respect to student dismissals. Now, the rules and regulations of the institution as set forth in this academic plan do not extend to the student the right to appear before either of these committees or the dean when the question is that of an evaluation of academic performance. The same document sets forth the fact that graduating requirements of the institution and the primary goal, naturally, is that of graduating competent and safe physicians, those that are qualified not only in basic medical science knowledge, but also qualified in the sense of clinical competency.
If the university provided for automatic dismissal or termination on failure for two successive years to maintain an average of 70, let us say, would they need a hearing if it developed that for 2 years the average was 60?
No, Your Honor, I do not believe that it would any more than in the case at bar, because it boils down to a question of the academic evaluation being placed upon the professors of the institution. It's for this reason the professors have given the evaluation of 60 in your example. The school has set forth requirements of an average of 70.
In other words, you're saying that when the judgment is subjective by committee, it's not any different from on a mathematical evaluation.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, because the subjective evaluation of the professors at the institution, University of Missouri, Kansas City, a numerical figure is not placed upon a student's performance. But obviously, in placing a 60 on the student performance, the subjective judgment of the professor is what leads to that conclusion. Now, the respondent in this case, Charlotte Horowitz, The university has never raised any question concerning this individual's intellectual ability. She came to the institution with fine academic credentials, having graduated from Barnard College in chemistry, Columbia University with a master's in psychology. She had 1 year in a PhD program in pharmacology at Duke, which was the same as the first year medical student curriculum. She attended the Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania, and for some 4 or 5 years prior to admission to University of Missouri, worked at the National Institute of Health.
Is your client a four-year school?
Sir, the University of Missouri Kansas City Medical School is a 6-year institution. By 6 years, I mean a student enters straight out of high school for a 6-year curriculum.
High school?
Yes, sir. 11 months a year. First 2 years primarily based with undergraduate work. The last 4 years primarily concerned with what is considered a typical type medical school arrangement.
And there are repeated references in the briefs to this criterion of being a safe physician. That was kind of a new term to me in this context. What does that mean?
Safe physician, as it was described in testimony at the trial court, is that the student has sufficient medical knowledge, basic science knowledge, and the student has the ability to function in a clinical setting with patients so as to render primary care to the general public. Now, it's been explained that that does not mean that the student is all knowledgeable in every conceivable medical question that would come up. But to be a safe physician, the student would have to have sufficient knowledge to know that it was going to be necessary to obtain the assistance of other physicians or healthcare professionals. So the goal of the institution and that of being a safe physician is that they can render care to the general public. Now, primary medical care, not advanced specialized type care, because naturally that comes from internships and residencies after they would graduate from a medical school.
Does the university run any other medical schools?
Yes, Your Honor, it does. The university operates a medical school on the campus in Columbia, Missouri. Mm-hmm. That medical school is what people have referred to as the traditional medical school.
That is a postgraduate school.
Yes, Your Honor. This is a school where to be admitted to that school, you must have an undergraduate degree.
Right.
And then you go into 4 years of medical school.
Right.
Now, the school at University of Missouri, Kansas City, is a school which is referred to as a docent-type institution, mm-hmm. whereby they have shortened the years overall, but they require going to school 11 months out of the year. Now, a docent is a physician, a professor, who is assigned the primary responsibility of guiding this student mm-hmm. throughout their entire...
And counseling. And
right, John.
Would I be correct in the inference that I drew from the briefs that the emphasis at this medical school is on producing practicing clinical physicians rather than on people who are going to devote their careers to medical research and so on?
That is true, Your Honor. The school has very readily stated from the very beginning, it's the reason that the school was established, was the responsibility to provide doctors to render primary care. And the school encourages students and notifies them of that fact when they are interviewed for admission to the school. And the respondent in this case at the time of application to the school and interview was so advised that the school requires not only basic medical science knowledge, but a clinical competency, that all students were going to be judged on the same basis as far as meeting any requirements for graduation.
Now, what's clinical competency mean?
Clinical competency, Your Honor, is the ability for a doctor to function in a patient setting. It is the ability to take the basic medical science knowledge which one learns from books and to apply that to a given patient, to a given situation. It involves all the way from acquiring a total and complete medical history from the patient to the proper type of examinations, the proper type of testing, and then the ability to relate the basic medical knowledge into a diagnosis and a formulation plan whereby that patient can be treated. And this is, unfortunately, the position where the institution found that the respondent in this case was not deemed to be qualified. Now,
this wasn't as a result of written or even oral examinations, but as a result of observation of her conduct in that setting. Is that it?
Yes, Your Honor, this is true. Now, the individual scored high on all written examinations, the didactic part of the work. Now, as was pointed out by her docent, and as pointed out by the trial judge after the trial, it's unfortunate, but the individual apparently assumed that she could become a doctor by reading a book and not treating patients and getting the necessary experience there. The clinical competency evaluation was naturally on the subjective judgment of the professors that she was under and that that viewed her performance in a clinical setting.
What were Excuse me, go ahead.
Yeah, I would also like to point out that the institution, after she had been on probation for a period of roughly 7 or 8 months, the committees, through the two committees and the dean, notified her that she would not be a candidate to graduate in May of 1973, some 5 months later. And an appeal was taken by the student, and the institution set up a panel of 7 doctors, none of which had had appreciable contact with the student, so as to get the opinions of others, just rather than the faculty itself of the school.
You say not appreciable. How much contact?
Well, Your Honor, none of them were instructors that instructed her in medical school.
Are you saying that they didn't have any contact?
No, Your Honor, I cannot say they didn't have any.
Well, how much?
Your Honor, I do not have the answer to that. They may have seen her at some time in a clinic, but they were none of them were docents of the school. None of them were classified as sub-docents in a hospital. It's just they may have bumped into the student at some time making clinical rounds in a hospital.
Well, how were they picked?
How were they picked?
Yeah.
Your Honor, they were selected.
Were they picked for their knowledge of her?
No, Your Honor, they were not. They were picked because each of these individuals had had prior experience as professors in a medical school. They were individuals that the dean knew had outstanding medical reputations, and since they had had prior experience with medical education, felt that they would be appropriate people to actually carry out a practical and oral examination.
And they were picked by the dean?
Yes, Your Honor. They were picked by the dean.
And what instructions were they given? Is that in the record?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. The instructions were by way of a conference which the dean held with each of these physicians. Also, on March 15th letter, which is in the appendix, the written instructions were given.
And they determined that her clinical ability was bad?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
What did they determine was bad?
Your Honor, the 7 individuals each, they did not meet as a composite group. Each one of them took the student through an oral and practical examination, functioning with one or more patients. Now, the result is that 1 out of the 7 said she was competent and qualified to graduate. That individual examined the student in pathology, which was strictly a laboratory setting with no patients involved. One doctor in general medicine recommended that she be graduated, though he said she would not be acceptable as an intern in his hospital. The other 5 physicians, each independent of one another, came in with recommendations to either drop the student immediately from medical school or saying she was not qualified to graduate. Now, each of these examinations has been described, and it was so described in the trial court, as being the equivalent of what the American Medical Association has for special board certification, where an individual will spend 3 to 4 hours with a given medical doctor in a clinical setting.
This is a little below the special board, isn't it? By 8 years, about, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. I was only pointing that out from the standpoint of view of the time element which is involved and the seriousness which the institution had. Following the...
At what level had Ms. Horowitz entered this school? You said this was a post-high school, six-year school for people who progressed from high school, but she had already been to college and to graduate school.
So yes, Your Honor.
What, did she come in the equivalent of the fifth year?
Yes, Your Honor, the equivalent of the fifth year. Uh-huh. And the reason being...
So she would have, if all had gone well, she would have been there for 2 years before graduation.
That's correct, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. And she was admitted as an advanced standing student because of her previous educational background and training.
What were the classes or sessions which the record indicated she failed to attend with regularity?
Well, Your Honor, the first time that a question arose with respect to clinical competency, it was the first rotation really she was on where a clinic was involved, was in March of 72, which is some 7 months after she started attending the institution. And they were having difficulty with respect to the clinical performance.
Mr. Wright, I'm a little interested, why was she admitted to the school at all in view of the type of emphasis they have on their education? Here was somebody with a college education, some medical experience, and they bring her in at an advanced standing. Do they bring many in this way?
They brought 13 students in with advanced standing.
Just because the school was new and needed them to fill up because it's hard to get into other medical schools, we have been told?
The school was new, Your Honor. I do not feel that it was a compulsion to fill the institution at all. The reason, as I previously stated, at the time of interviews with the student was advised as to the primary goals of the institution.
Does the record show where she had had medical school experience before and why she didn't stay there?
Your Honor, she had 1 year in a Ph.D. program in pharmacology at Duke University. Now, the significance of that is the fact that the Ph.D. program there, the first year, is the same curriculum as first-year medical students had at Duke University. She next attended the Women's Medical College in Pennsylvania, and after a few months withdrew in good standing because of ill health.
Sorry to ask you so many questions.
That's right.
Approximately how many students in each class?
Your Honor, the school...
At your client's school.
The school, you mean at the University of Missouri, Kansas City?
Yes.
Your Honor, I cannot give you the exact figures. I believe that the institution is running approximately 75 to 100 students per class.
And does the record show how many do not involuntarily leave?
No, Your Honor, there is nothing in the record pertaining
to... So as far as the record shows, Ms. Horowitz might have been the only one, or she might have been one of a dozen. Is that right?
As far as the record is concerned, that is true, Your Honor. I know there have been other students which have been dismissed for academic deficiency, but that is not in the record.
Mm-hmm. So we don't know if she was the only one or...
She was not the only one. Has not been the only one that has been dismissed from the institution for academic deficiencies.
Her year, were there any others? From her class, were there any others?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. I believe she was the only one that was dismissed at that time. Mm-hmm. Now, in this case, at the time that the respondent was dismissed from the medical school, the status of the law, so to speak, in the country was that it was not necessary for a student who was being dismissed for academic deficiencies to receive a notice of charges and a hearing.
You say at that time, you think,
yes, Your Honor.
Except for this case, the status of the law has changed?
No, Your Honor. I do not feel that it has. I think that the decision of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals in this case, and I respectfully submit this, that the court is mistaken in the interpretation which they not only placed upon an earlier decision of theirs, but upon a misinterpretation of decisions of this court. And I would speak primarily to the fact that The first case was that of Conley versus University of Vermont, a medical student case, where the court set forth the reasoning for there being no necessity for a notice of charges in the hearing. And there were several other cases, including the Fifth Circuit, which had held that that was true. Now, the Eighth Circuit had handed down a Greenhill decision. It's Greenhill v. Bailey, out of the Medical School of the University of Iowa. In that case, the Eighth Circuit specifically held that the student was entitled to a notice of charges and a hearing. But what they said in that case was that because the school had stated that the student did not have the intellectual ability to be a doctor. And further, they communicated that to the Association of American Medical Colleges. Now, they italicized in their opinion the fact that they were not sending this back for any hearing on performance of the student or an academic evaluation. So I would submit that the case did not stand for what the Eighth Circuit majority indicated that it did. Now, there was a dissent. We requested a rehearing or transfer court in bank. The Chief Justice of the Eighth Circuit wrote a dissent joined by two other judges pointing out that they had misinterpreted Greenhill. And one of the other judges that joined in the dissent actually wrote the opinion in Greenhill. Now, the Eighth Circuit also relied upon the Roth decision of this court in 1972. Now, Roth involved a non-tenured professor in the state of Wisconsin. The court in that case did not find a deprivation of liberty interest, nor did it find a deprivation of property interest. The court looked to the law of Wisconsin, looked to rules and regulations of the institution, as to whether or not there was a property interest, and found none to exist. Now, I would submit that in the case we have before the court today, that a student in higher education in the state of Missouri does not have a right to a medical education. There are no statutes in the state of Missouri extending such right. Secondly, the University of Missouri, the rules and regulations of that university, do not extend such a right. With respect to the liberty interest that was covered in Roth, the court looked to the good name, reputation, honor, and integrity as to whether or not it was adversely affected by what the government was doing to the given individual. As I previously stated, the court found in that case that there was not a stigma, there was not a liberty interest. Because of the fact that there was no showing that there was a charge or allegation of dishonesty, immorality, or that the charge was going to seriously damage the standing of the individual in the community. Now, I would submit to the court that this is certainly the situation in the case that we're considering today, because the university at no point in time has ever challenged the honesty, the morality, the integrity, or the intellectual ability of this student. I would further submit that the liberty interest of a medical student in the University of Missouri is not any greater than the liberty interest of a non-tenured professor. Now, in the Roth decision, it was pointed out that the individual might be somewhat less attractive for other employment. And I don't think there's any question about what the individual would be somewhat less attractive. But the individual was not foreclosed from seeking other employment, even in the state of Wisconsin. I would submit that in the case which we have, I don't think there's any question but what the student would be somewhat less attractive to other medical schools.
She couldn't be admitted to any other one, could she, unless she was subject to be readmitted to this one? Isn't that what the rule is?
No, Your Honor, I do not believe that that is the rule.
Isn't that the rule among the Association of Medical Colleges?
Not to my knowledge, no, sir. It is not.
You don't know?
I do not. I cannot answer clearly 100% guarantee, no, sir, but I do not believe that that is the ruling of the association.
Was there any evidence on that subject at all?
Yes, Your Honor, there was evidence. There was one of the seven examining physicians, Dr. Cohen, stated that he felt that a dismissal for academic deficiency would affect the ability of the student to get into other medical schools and to obtain employment in other areas, health-related areas. Now, I would submit that there isn't any question but what they're going to be somewhat less attractive. But it does not foreclose.
Did Dr. Cohen attribute that to some fixed rule or just his subjective judgment?
No, Your Honor, I think it was his subjective judgment. And he readily admitted that medical experts can disagree as far as the performance of a given individual or a given student.
Well, maybe I should ask, is this school approved by the association?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
When?
Well, it had provisional accreditation when it opened its doors in 1971.
And when did it get final approval?
Well, Your Honor, it received approval approximately, I believe, 6 or 7 months ago.
So the rule of the association wouldn't apply to this case, would it?
What rule is that, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
That you can't be admitted unless you are eligible to be readmitted to the school that you were let out of.
Well, Your Honor, the situation is in the performance or the evaluation and the final action as far as dismissal of the student, the dean very readily pointed out to the coordinating committee, which is in the record, of the fact that this student was free to apply for readmission to this school.
Mr. Wright,
yes, Your Honor.
You stated that there's no right in Missouri to a medical education. I think we could accept that, certainly assume it for the moment. Is the situation changed after the medical school accepts an individual for admission to the medical school? At least there is some expectation of graduating, isn't there?
Your Honor, I do not feel that the situation changes. Undoubtedly, the student is closer to becoming a medical doctor. But the admission to the school means that the student is entitled to be treated in the same manner as other students in that institution.
But might not that sometimes present a question as to whether or not the student is so treated?
Your Honor, that question arose in this case.
Yes.
The allegations were very specific in this area, and the finding was specifically that there was no disparate treatment between students in the institution.
Mr. Wright, if she had graduated, would she automatically have been eligible to practice medicine, or would she have had to take a further examination of some kind? Something in the record suggests graduation qualifies the person to practice.
Your Honor, you must graduate from an accredited medical school in the state of Missouri before you're even eligible.
I understand.
For admission to the practice of medicine. The students take examinations while they are in school and then also after school in order to qualify for the practice of medicine in Missouri. I reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Very well. Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, the respondent, Charlotte Horowitz, in this case, was admitted to the medical school, as petitioners have acknowledged, in the fall of 1971 as an advanced standing student. At that time, it is correct that she was expected to graduate within approximately 2 years, although the evidence in the record, appearing at pages 87 and 88 of the testimony, is that that was the bare minimum of time which it would require her to graduate, because she did not have the extensive medical background that some of her classmates admitted as advanced standing had, such as having completed a degree in oral surgery. That 2 years was a bare minimum when she was admitted to this medical school. At the time she was admitted to the medical school, There were no course requirements for graduation. It was not specified, and the parties have stipulated to this in Stipulation 92 that appears at page 25 of the appendix, that there were no particular number of courses had to be passed in order to graduate, and that there was no particular number of courses which, if failed, would result in dismissal. The parties have also stipulated that Stipulation number 29 at page 12, that this student passed every single course by receiving a satisfactory grade in every course up until May 1, 1973, at the time the committees finally determined she would not graduate. In addition, the term satisfactory completion of the course is defined by stipulations of the party at Stipulation 82 on page 23 as meaning that this student had met the standards of acceptable performance by students at this school. So at the time, she had virtually completed her 2 years at the medical school. She had passed every single course by receiving a satisfactory grade and had been so informed. It is apparent.
What about her patient relationship?
That's just what I was going to address.
That's one of the elements in the medical education.
Yes, the courses she took included clinical rotations. For instance, pediatrics was a rotation which she took, which included clinical exposure to sick children as well as to the healthy children. And she received a satisfactory grade for that, and it was communicated to her. But at the same time she was completing that course and during that course, some of the faculty were adversely evaluating her performance and were documenting their beliefs that her performance was somewhat less than satisfactory. And yet, from the record, it's clear that she never saw those evaluations until after this litigation was commenced and they were produced in discovery. She did not know that it had been deemed by some of her professors that she had, although received a satisfactory grade, had not satisfactorily enough completed those courses. She did know, however, that she was having some difficulty in clinical competence. The first that she learned was the July 5, 1972 letter placing her on probation. That letter, which appears in the appendix at page 180, however, reflects only a concern about her relationships with other persons. And then with regard to the clinical aspect of that, states that in order to improve her relationships with other persons, she needs to begin keeping to established schedules and meeting all clinical responsibilities on time and gracefully. We're still not certain as to what meeting a clinical responsibility gracefully means, but that was the first reference to some allegation that she was somehow deficient in clinical abilities.
Mr. Benson, assuming that a medical school or any other school said that in order to graduate, you must have a passing grade in every subject that you take, anything wrong with that?
No. I'm sure many schools do.
Well, if they had that at this school, do they?
No, they did not. It's the parties stipulation number 92 that they did not.
That they did not have to take them, but didn't they say they had to pass?
No, the stipulation, I believe, is on page 25, is that the policies and regulations of the medical school do not state the requirements for graduation in terms of the successful completion of any number, and it should be or percentage of courses, nor do the policies of the medical school specify that students should not be graduated for not having successfully completed a course of courses.
Well, what is the basis of graduation?
Well, that's...
You see what my trouble...
That's an excellent question, and that is something that this student, having gone through 2 years of this medical school, having up until May 1st of 1973, having received a satisfactory grade, and the only grades that you get at this medical school are satisfactory, unsatisfactory, or no credit, having gotten the highest grade that she could receive.
But I assume you to say if they did require passing in every subject, you wouldn't be here.
Well, no, that's not quite right, because...
You're going to upset a whole lot of schools in this country.
Our allegation is that when a professional graduate school, where the student is in a school with an aim towards a career in a particular field, and that school slams the door in the face of that student being able to get into that professional field, that is a foreclosure of a full range of employment opportunities, which this court has in the past in similar circumstances and should, in this case, require a due process hearing.
Mr. Benson, you say that the graduation or for kicking somebody out, in effect, of a professional graduate school forecloses employment opportunities. But surely that forecloses fewer professional opportunities than being flunked out of college. Being flunked out of college forecloses fewer than being flunked out of high school. It seems to me that if we were to adopt your question, your proposition, we would be left with a proposition that there's a due process hearing for flunking anyone out of any public educational institution.
Well, I believe that that would be correct, and I don't believe that is should be an impediment to adopting such a ruling, because in Goss versus Lopez, this court has required due process hearings for clearly disciplinary reasons. Now, when if the court agrees that there is a foreclosure of a range of professional or employment opportunities, then a due process hearing is required. But the format of that due process hearing can be determined by the institution within the guidelines of the Matthews versus Eldridge decision of this court. And in the example that you gave, a student who flunked some courses in history in an undergraduate college might find the due process requirement satisfied simply by a letter from the dean indicating that the student had failed courses A, B, and C, and that if the student differed with that finding, that he could appear in the dean's office on Friday at 1:30, and if he'd like to see the records, he could ask in advance for them to be produced, and he could have a hearing with the dean. I believe that would suffice, and many educational institutions do that informally or formally now throughout the nation. And so requiring a due process hearing before a student is expelled would not place any substantial burden upon any of the educational institutions. In a professional graduate situation, however, the due process hearing under Matthews versus Eldridge type of test might be somewhat more involved. In this case, all we're asking for is some written specifications to this student who had thought throughout her college career, her graduate career, that she was satisfactorily completing the requirements of the course.
What about the probation only 6 months after she entered the school?
Yes. At the completion of her first year, she was placed on probation. As I indicated, the probation letter stated that her clinical deficiencies had to do with being on time and meeting her responsibilities gracefully. It was in a later letter, it was advised in the term clinical competence. That, I believe, is the February 1973 letter, which...
That letter was a little more detailed than timeliness and grace.
The probation letter of July stated keeping to established schedules, meeting all clinical responsibilities on time and gracefully, and that's the only reference to clinical.
But it goes on.
And it goes on to say...
You don't need to, but it certainly says more than those two things.
Yes, and it says attending gracefully to personal appearance, carefully to personal appearance, including hand washing and grooming, participating appropriately in the activities of the school, and directing criticisms and suggestions maturely to her docent. Now, those are types of what we maintain are clearly conduct-related accusations.
Well, didn't that put her on notice quite early that all was not well?
Yes, it did. No doubt about that. And she received additional notice in the February 7th letter, which appears at 182 of the appendix, when she was told that she would not graduate. And she was told that the reasons were clinical competence, but it's not further specified or defined, peer and patient relations, personal hygiene, and ability to accept criticism. It appears that it's a condensation of the same four reasons that had been spelled in the July 5th letter of probation.
Mr. Benson, the due process clause of the 14th Amendment comes into play if and only if there is a deprivation of life, liberty, or property. Now, clearly here there was not a deprivation of life. It's not clear to me so far from your oral argument whether your claim is that there was a deprivation of liberty or of property. I'd understood your brief to say only that there was a deprivation of liberty.
Our primary...
But now you have implied, at least as I understood it, that there was some sort of a... that upon acceptance to this educational institution, there was a vested right to graduate, and if so, that would be a claim that there was a property right.
That's correct.
Equivalent of, more or less, analogous to a tenure for a faculty member rather than But I didn't understand that claim to be made at all in your brief.
Well, in our brief, we primarily addressed ourselves to the question of the liberty interest of the foreclosure of a poor
Because unless there's one of those three deprivations,
That's
the
right.
due process clause is not implicated at all.
Well, I believe in this case she primarily has been deprived of her liberty interest in pursuing her chosen career, or a common occupation of life in the medical profession. I believe that's been clearly established by, one, the fact that she had a job at the North Carolina Medical School, Department of Psychiatry, contingent upon receiving the degree from the school. When she did not get the degree from the school, she lost the job at North Carolina. That's a clear foreclosure of an employment opportunity, and which is of record. And secondly, Dr. Cohen testified in his expert and uncontroverted testimony that the student was virtually precluded from ever again obtaining admission to any other medical school or finding employment in medically related field, a clear deprivation of her liberty interest in employment. Now, with regard to the property interest, I believe that is secondary, but nonetheless important, because at the time she entered the school, she had, I believe, a reasonable expectation of an entitlement to a degree if she would meet the requirements of the school. Now, the school here did not spell out its requirements for graduation.
But it did tell her that she hadn't met them.
It told her that she had not met them and that she would not be graduated.
Right.
Now, there's a difference between not being graduated and being dismissed from the school, because at the time she was told that she would not be graduated, there was the expectation that she would be continued in school for an additional length of time. The school called that deceleration. And other students were decelerated. In fact, she was specifically told that the committees would meet at some later time to determine whether or not she would be continued in school or dismissed. And in May of 1973, the decision was made that after this reviewing procedure, that no new information had been presented, and the school would stand by its decision not to graduate her. Then, at the end of that month, a whole new set of hearings were held without knowledge to her, without an opportunity to attend, at which it was decided she would be dismissed from the school. And so she was placed on notice that she would not graduate, but she was never placed on notice that she would be dismissed from the school.
I want to take you back to the two letters that you referred to. At page 180, the first paragraph refers to frequent and long discussions. And then at page 182, again, the letter opens. That's in February 73. Refers to long and detailed meetings which she had had with various doctors. Then it concludes, toward the conclusion of our meeting, the point was made that you have the option of requesting a special set of oral and practical examinations as an appeal of the decisions which were discussed in our meeting and which are set forth in this letter. Did she ever ask for those oral examinations?
Yes, she did.
And then what happened?
The seven examining physicians reviewed her, interviewed her, and they submitted their findings. Of the seven, two recommended that she graduate, two recommended that she be dismissed, two recommended that she be continued on probation, and the recommendation of the seventh is indeterminate. But in any event, there was no clear majority of the recommendations from those seven examining physicians, and the medical school had established a tallying procedure as what to do in the event there was no clear majority, and that required calling the physicians together so that they might discuss their evaluations and resolve their differences. And yet the medical school failed to do this, failed to take advantage of the rule that was for the advantage of the student. And I think that's an important failure on the part of the medical school, because it precluded the opportunity that these seven examining physicians might have come together, having discussed their differences, and agreed that perhaps it would be appropriate to continue her on probation to allow her the deceleration option that was available to medical
If school. The seven had such a collegial process and voted 4-3 that she was not to continue as a student, would you be here?
Well, we may be, because the...
Well, that's important.
It is. The process is not really an appeal, although it was called an appeal by the medical school. It was purely advisory. It was not to a higher body within the school that had any ultimate decision-making authority. And in this case, there was... the recommendations from the examining physicians came back to the same committee that had requested them. So it was not an appeal, and whether that meets the procedural requirements of due process, I doubt. But in any event, that did not happen here, and the recommendations came back without any unanimity, much less a majority opinion.
Mr. Benson, in response to my brother Stewart's question, you said that your brief discussed primarily the liberty interest, but suggested it also discussed property interest. Do you remember offhand where in your brief you discussed property interest?
The statement of facts. So I did not. We discussed the questions as her admissions, the interview at the time, the fact that she was interested in academic psychiatry at the time she was admitted, that the school was offering a clinical program.
Is any part of the legal portion of your brief devoted to a discussion?
No, it is not.
But you are relying on it here.
Well, our primary reliance is upon...
Well, yes or no? Are you relying it on property interest? Yes.
Yes.
The case really is a procedural due process case, I take it.
As it approaches this case
if you had had what you thought was full procedural due process, would you think the decision to expel would be subject to judicial review?
Well, if it were the same decision, it would be subject to judicial review only on an allegation of arbitrary or capriciousness.
Well, now... I take it that there was a full trial in the district court
yes.
on whether or not she was properly expelled within the rules of the university.
Well, the issue in the trial court was whether or not she was entitled to due process prior to her dismissal.
Well,
the court made findings that she had been dismissed for reasons which were adequate, but that was not the...
And full compliance with the university rules had been had.
That's correct, but that
now,
was...
Why do you think the hearing that she had in the district court with respect to the validity of her dismissal doesn't satisfy any procedural due process requirements?
One of the advantages of a procedural due process hearing within the educational institution is, as this court recognized in Goss versus Lopez, is to give the aggrieved student an opportunity to characterize his conduct. It would provide an opportunity to submit.
She had plenty of opportunity to characterize her conduct here in the district court, I take it.
Yes, but the question before the district court was only whether she had a legal entitlement to a pre-dismissal hearing. It was not she did not come to the district court to offer evidence in mitigation, for instance, nor to characterize her conduct with regard to whether she should be entitled to a deceleration option or not. Those issues were not before the district court.
Let me ask it this way. Suppose you won here and that the Court of Appeals was for what standard would the court require the university to impose as a pre-eviction ruling? Just probable cause to believe, or would they have to make some final...
In order to hold the hearing or to effect the dismissal?
To effect the dismissal.
Well, the
What standard do they apply, and must they? What kind of a finding must they make prior to dismissal?
They may make any finding within their discretion, provided it is neither arbitrary nor capricious nor in bad faith.
Well, yes, but what if they say there's probable cause for us to believe that you don't... that you don't measure up, so you're being dismissed, but there'll be a full hearing available to you later.
Well,
where we then must make a final judgment.
Well, I believe that it should be a prior hearing, prior to dismissal, to meet the requirements of
what
not.
What case do you rely on for that?
Well, in the
where the administrative hearing must make a final. Judgment on the merits.
Well, in order to avoid foreclosing the range of employment opportunities, I believe it's a reasonable inference to require.
What if she was dismissed and then she had an opportunity for a full hearing and she won it?
And if the hearing were held sometime immediately following her dismissal, I suppose it would meet the requirements of due process, provided it were sufficiently soon after her dismissal to avoid the foreclosure of a range of employment opportunities.
Well, what if there was an administrative hearing in which they listened to her side of the story, but they made they concluded there was reasonable cause to dismiss, and then told her, if you like a full hearing, we'll see you in court.
Well, in court would not be satisfactory for a number of reasons. First, legally, the judge, the federal district court would not have the authority to weigh facts in mitigation.
Well, what case do you rely on that the final due process hearing that makes the final judgment must be administrative rather than judicial?
It's the state that is foreclosing the range of employment opportunities, so it must be the state which affords the due process hearing.
They have a court system and say, "Well, we just want to make sure we have a disinterested judge. We don't want to be accused of that, and we don't want to be accused of having inadequate procedures, no cross examination. So we'll have the full, we'll give you the full treatment in court. And if you object to the burden of proof, we will assume it."
If the state wished to establish that by statute, that would, in my opinion, meet the requirements of due process. But that didn't happen here.
Well, it's already established by statute in the sense that she can go to court and sue the university.
No, because she can only go to court under the 42 U.S.C. 1983 seeking an adjudication that she was entitled to a due process hearing
couldn't
from
she
the
go
state.
To, well, I know, but couldn't she go and have the into a state court and have the kind of a hearing she wanted?
I believe she could only have a hearing on the issue of whether or not she was entitled to a hearing from the state.
Why is that? I thought you said it was subject to judicial review, the judgment of the...
Only the ultimate decision of the agency, which is foreclosing the employment opportunities, is subject to the limited judicial review of arbitrary and capricious deprivation of her rights.
Well, how would they determine arbitrariness unless they reviewed the merits?
Well, the burden of proof would be substantially different, and that's no different than existing law right now. Any student who believes that he or she has been arbitrarily deprived of a property liberty interest may go to federal district court. Under the due process hearing, which we believe is required here, that judicial review would be facilitated because a due process would require a written notice, and it would require some record of the due process hearing. That might only be minutes, but that would provide a record of the due process hearing. A presumption of regularity would attach to it, and the burden of proof would be substantial for a student who wished to go on to court to review that decision on an allegation.
You don't
of
want anything more than Goss against Lopez, do you?
Beg your pardon?
You don't want any more than is in Goss against Lopez.
Well, I don't believe the issue is now before us as to whether or not there's a right of counsel, for instance, in such a due process hearing. I believe
well,
that's
what I wanted. No, would you be satisfied with it?
I believe that it would be sufficient to allow the medical institution to, in the first instance, establish its procedures that meet the minimal requirements of due process, so that this court is not in the position of dictating the format of a due process hearing for every graduate education institution in the United States. Some might find that the right of counsel would not facilitate the due process hearing, and in others where the issues are more complicated, the right of counsel might be of advantage
well,
both
why
to the school
in the world
and
do you want counsel?
Well, I'm not certain that counsel...
You want a little edge on the other side now, don't you?
Well, on both sides, if counsel were available, I'm sure it would be available to both sides. But difficult...
You don't insist on that, do you?
We're not insisting on a right of counsel at this point. We're
You'd
simply...
We'd
be satisfied with an administrative hearing within the educational institution, provided that the rules were established in advance and that there was written notice and that there was some
Mr.
means
Benson,
of a record.
What is the principal procedural defect that you complain of, you're entitled to due process? What is the principal defect in the proceedings given your client by the university?
The student Horowitz was not advised in writing of the details of the reason.
Does the Constitution require it be in writing rather than oral? Was she advised orally? There's a lot of testimony and some findings about literally hundreds of oral conversations.
She had hundreds of oral conversations with her docent, who is the primary teaching. And her docent was repeatedly telling her that her clinical competency was sufficient to graduate. And
well, that's not what the district court found.
Well, that's what his testimony is in the record of the.
He testified that on hundreds of occasions, or over 100 occasions, he told her that her appearance was unsatisfactory, and that repeatedly she was advised she had to have a white, clean white coat. Now I don't know how important that is, but supposing she did not have a clean white coat and never got one, Would it be arbitrary for them to say you cannot graduate if you can't form a habit of wearing a clean white coat when you interview patients?
No, I do not believe that would be arbitrary.
Well, was she not advised that that was one requirement she had to cure?
Yes, and there's no evidence that she
well,
did not...
Well, then why didn't she have adequate notice?
That she did not cure it. Well, the adequate notice that I was about to mention was to the school places great reliance upon the clinical competence, and yet the allegations of her alleged deficiencies in clinical competence were never spelled out to her in any means.
And never. Now, do you insist? Is the principal? I want to know what the major weakness is. Is it it was oral rather than in writing,
at
all?
The major weakness in this case was that she had no opportunity to appear before the committee with knowledge of what was
before seven separate doctors.
Yeah, but they had no authority. Their judgments were
subject to
review. Covered the gamut of recommendations, and it was ignored by the medical school. But the major
ignored by the medical school?
The judgments of the medical school, a majority of them, at least four, recommended either that she graduate on schedule or that she be continued on probation. Four of the seven recommended one of those two options, and yet that recommendation was ignored. And she was dismissed from the medical school. But the major deficiency is that she never had an opportunity to appear before the coordinating committee, which was the committee which was making the decision as to whether or not she should be graduated or not. And she had no opportunity to appear before that committee, armed with the allegations against her, knowledge of them, notice of them, and with an opportunity to rebut them. And she had no opportunity to argue before that committee the circumstances that would characterize her conduct.
This argument would be equally strong in your view, even if she had such opportunity before each of the seven doctors who did interview her in person.
Well, if she did, and if they had authority to
make the decision, they could only recommend. It's not enough to appear before a recommending group. She must appear before the final decision maker.
That's right. So, so that she could argue mitigation. So that she could argue the characterization of her conduct in the event that she decided to do that instead of denying the
allegations.
You know,
there are a lot of bar review procedures where the lawyer who's subject to discipline appears before a committee that then makes a recommendation either to the court or to some other body before whom he does not specifically appear. And I think that's generally been thought all right.
But those recommendations, as I understand them, are binding unless overturned by a higher authority.
Do you have a case that holds that there's a right to appear before the decision maker as opposed to before a body making recommendations to the decision maker?
I'm certain that there are cases, but I cannot
recall
one.
This is your critical argument. You have no case right on
this. And I believe Goss versus Lopez states in it that's a conduct-related case, that the right to due process hearing is before some authority of the school.
You think it's constitutionally deficient to have seven doctors interview a person considered for graduation at length, discuss the whole problem, then the seven make written recommendations to the president of the university. The president of the university can't decide whether to dismiss without interviewing the student himself. That's your position.
In this case, it is for two reasons, because the majority opinion of the recommendation of those seven examining physicians was ignored, and because the procedure of the school in establishing that process of examination was also ignored, and that the seven examining physicians were not called together to discuss their opinions and to resolve differences. So in that respect, she was denied procedural due process because the school failed to follow its own rules.
Well, no, that's a different critical defect, failure to follow its own rules.
That's right, and we discussed that more fully in the brief. But the primary importance of a due process hearing here is for Horowitz to have had an opportunity to have come forward and said, I only had 2 years at this medical school. I may have some clinical deficiencies. It was expected that I might require more. I see that my time has expired.
May I ask one other question, because I may have missed it in your argument. You emphasized the distinction between failure to graduate and being dismissed.
Yes.
You said she had notice of the former but not the latter.
Yes.
But the letter of February 7, 1973, from Dean Novak says you may have to make improvement or you will not be able to continue in the medical school after May of this year. Isn't that notice of possible dismissal?
Well, it's a warning, but the decision,
what else is a notice?
The decision as to whether or not to graduate her was not to be considered until May of 1973, and it was decided at that time to initiate a series of committee meetings to determine whether or not she should be dismissed.
But is this not notice that she was subject to dismissal?
Well, I think she knew all along. Any student knows all along that you can be dismissed for something, that the schools have the authority to dismiss a student at some point for some time. But she never received formal notice from the school that she had, because of certain deficiencies which were spelled out in the notice, a committee would be meeting to determine whether or not she should be dismissed, and that she'd have an opportunity to appear at that meeting and rebut the allegations. Thank you.
Mr. Wright.
Mr. Chief Justice, please the court. I would like to merely point out to the court that it did not come as a bolt of lightning from the sky to this student when the student was notified of dismissal from the institution. It started in March of 1972 with the clinical competency problem in pediatrics, of which she was advised of the problem by her docent. We then get to the point where in July of 72, when she's placed on probation by the institution after the committees had considered it, the dean, the chairman of the Council on Evaluation, and her docent sat down and discussed with her all the problems that she was having. She received a written notification setting forth the same factors. Again, in October 1972, 3 months later, her docent was concerned about her performance.
Well, Mr. Wright,
yes.
I take it your position is that the total process to which she was due, the university gave her. That was the end of the line. She never was going to have another hearing inside the university or out.
No, Your Honor, obviously she would have a hearing outside, because that's why we're here today, but my position...
I know, but how about in the state court? Could she have got review of the university's decision to expel her?
Your Honor, I think that she could have.
Well, you think, is there some established statutory procedure?
No, Your Honor, I'm sorry, there is not.
Well, what would she have done? If she had gone to state court and wanted to have a full-blown trial on her expulsion, could she have obtained it?
Your Honor, I don't believe so, because I do not believe that the courts in Missouri, at least to my knowledge, will not get into the subjective evaluation.
So your answer is that under Missouri law, she was already at the end of the line when the university made its own decision. She could not get it reviewed in the state courts.
No, Your Honor. Not as far as these... subjective evaluation of grading is concerned.
Well, or on any other basis, she could get no review in the state courts of that decision to expel.
Yes, I believe she could have. Well, from the standpoint of view of whether or not the decision was arbitrary or capricious, or without basis in fact, the same as it is in the federal courts.
Well, was there an established procedure for doing that under the Missouri statutes?
No, Your Honor. There's not a...
the Missouri court can enforce 1983, can it not? The state courts?
What, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
The state courts could apply Section 1983, could they not?
Well, I believe they could from the standpoint...
Well, that's a process, isn't it?
Well, yes, Your Honor. I believe it is. And it...
Of course, my question, Mr. Wright, is what about state law?
Yeah. State law, Your Honor, does not require the university to have a notice of charges and a hearing.
No, but Mr. Wright, I gather some review of administrative agency determination in Missouri courts, is there not?
Oh, yes, most certainly.
Would this fit within any of those procedures, whatever they may be?
I believe that it could, because there are specific statutory provisions whereby one can appeal out of an administrative hearing.
Would there be a hearing de novo in any such a proceeding, or would it be just a review on the record and an affirmance, unless there was some basis for finding it arbitrary or capricious?
I believe, Your Honor, it would be a review on the record.
Isn't there a precedent that the University of Missouri is subject to mandamus action? case of Gaines against Canada?
Most certainly, Your Honor.
It's
true.
The time has expired, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear our...